I'll explain my slide later. This is from a very popular TV show. In fact, I haven't had a TV for 20 years, so that's how popular the show is. I've actually heard of it. But I'll explain it later. It's really about this model organism that I use to study endocrine disruptors and whether or not this model amphibian is really appropriate for the work that I'm doing. Before I do that, before I explain to you my title, I always start with this phrase. It's a proverb that I learned while working in Southern Africa, which loosely translated means people are people through other people. So I never present myself and my work without first acknowledging the people who make me who I am. First and foremost, my family, in particular, my mother and father. I wouldn't be here without them. For their love and support for 50 years, my wonderful wife, Catherine Kim, and my two kids, well, my two adults who used to be kids. I also want to thank my funding sources. It of course costs money to do work, and I have been funded by the chemical manufacturer that makes the chemical that I study, but not so much anymore. And finally, I want to thank, there's several iterations here, the students that have been involved in the work that I've done over the last, work that they've done, I guess, over the last 20 years. And this is my current group. It's a wonderfully diverse group of people, including the children of migrant farm workers and other agricultural workers. So they've experienced the work that we do firsthand. And finally, this is dedicated to my grandmother. So I got involved in all this endocrine disruptor stuff about 20 years ago, a little over 20 years ago, when the largest chemical company in the world at the time, Novartis, asked me to study their number one selling product, the herbicide atrazine, shown here. It's a weed killer that's mostly used on corn. It's been used since 1958. And we use about 80 million pounds. It's the second largest agrochemical in the world. And it's used in more than 80 countries, but now outlawed in all of Europe. Or as the company says, it has been denied regulatory approval by the European Union. Whatever the language you use, the point is the company's based in Europe and we're using 80 million pounds of something that's not allowed on the continent. They came and they asked me to figure out if atrazine was an endocrine disruptor in amphibians. And of course, if you study amphibians, you study Xenopus laevis, the African clawed frog. It is not just the frog, but it's used as the amphibian representing salamanders and Sicilians. I'm saying all of that sarcastically. It's the most unfrog frog you could ever imagine. It can't jump, it doesn't have a tongue, it has a lateral line system like a fish, it never leaves the water, but it was used in pregnancy tests in the early 1900s, so that's why everybody uses it in the laboratory, and that's why the company wanted me to use the model amphibian. I'll tell you what we really know about her later. In fact, my African clawed frogs at the time, because I was trying to save money, didn't really come from Africa. My African frogs came from San Diego. I started my colony, yeah, they were introduced into the US. I started my colony when my son was about 2 years old. So I started my colony 23 years ago in San Diego. And that's going to become important later in my story. In fact, my frogs, I guess, are African-American clawed frogs, as a matter of fact, but that's irrelevant. We started working with the company. We showed that atrazine inhibited growth of the voice box or the larynx in exposed males, which suggested that they had reduced testosterone levels. We went on to show that, in fact, some of those animals, depending on the populations you'll see, developed as hermaphrodites with mixtures of testes and ovaries. You know, one pair of gonads will get you in enough trouble. Certainly, this set of gonads gotten me in plenty of trouble. Point is, this is not normal. Amphibians don't naturally develop as hermaphrodites, even though there are some fish that do. We went on to show, as you heard last night from Pete Myers, that some of the animals, depending on the population, even though they were genetic males, completely turned into females. So you're looking at a pair of copulating males in terms of the genetics. But the one on the bottom, which is acting as the female, is completely functional, and they typically are. They grow up, they can lay eggs, and completely function as females, even though they're genetically male. Furthermore, we went on to show that of those males that don't turn into females, they have very reduced fertility. And here we just measured fertility based on the number of eggs that individual males could fertilize. And while control males can fertilize about 85% of a female's eggs, they lay about 2,000 eggs, atrazine-treated males had fertility rates that were down at about 15%. These fertility rates were down at 15% because, one, they didn't show the behavior So they would just sit there and watch the females lay the eggs. They wouldn't even try. But two, if you look at their testes under the microscope, you don't have to be a histologist to see the difference here. And we did all the fancy statistics and p-values and measured stuff, but it's pretty clear when you look at the controls, these are testicular tubules full of sperm. And under the controls, the testicular tubules are essentially have cellular debris and are devoid of sperm. They don't have enough testosterone to maintain the behavior or the sperm. It turns out that they don't have enough testosterone for the following reasons. If you have a testis, you should make testosterone. In fact, the word testosterone is a portmanteau. Do you guys know that word? I'm proud. I didn't learn it until I was 49 years old. It's when you stick two words together like smoke and fog, you get smog, twist and jerk, you get twerk. Testosterone literally means testicular hormone. It's the male hormone. But if you inappropriately turn on the enzyme aromatase, you convert that testosterone into estrogen, another portmanteau that means the generator of estrus. And the results are, if you're an amphibian, your testosterone's used up, so you can't make sperm, you don't show male behaviors. And you're also feminized, you make eggs and ovaries, because now you're making estrogen when you shouldn't be. And we've gone on to study that mechanism in many ways that I don't have time to talk about today. What I became concerned about, and I think the point of this conference is, One Health, One Planet, is if the runoff, and this is a slide I took in Uganda, if the runoff from this crop is affecting frogs and fish, how is it also affecting the animals that come to drink from that water? How is it also affecting the humans, in this case, that are using that same water as a source of cooking water and drinking water and bathing water in the nearby village? I believe that environmental health and public health are one and the same. I'm not sure why we tend to talk about those things separately. Maybe not in this room, but in general. I study frogs, though. I can't study everything. And so I ended up contacting many, many people, including Val Beasley, among others, and asking, are you seeing these kinds of effects? And looking through the published literature to show that not only were these kinds of effects produced by atrazine in amphibians and fish, but there are also studies showing similar things happening in reptiles, in birds, and in mammals. So our top model was maybe not only a good model for amphibians, but maybe a good model for animals, vertebrate animals in general. In fact, we published a paper. Val Beasley was one of the co-authors on the paper. And I invented the word gonadotoxin in this paper. The company lawyers got really upset. They actually tried to have it retracted because they said gonadotoxin is not a word. Aren't all words not words before they're words? I don't know. Plus, I went to Harvard. I can make up a word. So, at any rate, what we ended up showing in a nutshell in this paper is here are my, well, not my testes, but here's the testes of a frog. Control, give it atrazine, it's devoid of sperm. This is a guy in Belgium that showed the same thing in fish. This is work that was done in Argentina by a couple showing same thing in the testes of caiman. It's like a big alligator. Sperm in the testes, give it atrazine, no sperm. This is rats. This work was done in Nigeria and Croatia. I didn't know these people before we wrote this paper. Sperm in the testicular tubules, that you give it atrazine and there's no sperm. And there's this work that was done in Pakistan on birds showing you get the same effect when you expose birds to atrazine. Sperm in the testis, give it atrazine, no sperm. So this was a ubiquitous, our top model was really telling us something not just about amphibians, but about vertebrate animals in general. The reduction of testosterone with atrazine exposure was demonstrated across vertebrate animals. And what's more is the induction of aromatase has also been shown in the increase in estrogen across multiple animals. In ectotherms, it typically leads to vitellogenesis and oogenesis, or the yolking up of eggs. And we showed that in our frogs. So this is eggs in the testis. This is something I learned from Val Beasley. He taught me this histology. But I was the one who coined the term testicular oocytes. I like to make up words. Upsets the company for some reason. But here's similar findings in fish. This is work by Don Tillett and others. And this is work in reptiles, again, showing these eggs growing in the testis associated with exposure to atrazine in laboratory animals. Now, in mammals, you won't grow eggs in your testes, so there's the good news. But aromatase is very important in two of the top cancers in humans, mammary cancer and prostate cancer. There are studies to start to look at the human issues. There are studies, this is work from my colleague Shauna Swan, showing that men in Columbia, Missouri, with atrazine in their urine, that there's a statistically significant association between low sperm count and atrazine contamination as measured by atrazine in the urine. Now, that's just a correlation. But imagine if you're exposed to atrazine in the laboratory, doesn't matter if you're a fish or an amphibian or a reptile or a bird or a rat, your sperm count goes down. You don't have sperm in your testes. And just by coincidence, if you have atrazine in your urine, it tends to be associated with low semen quality, low sperm count, and low fertility. By the way, the level of atrazine in this urine, 0.1 parts per billion, is the level where we start to see chemical castration in our frogs and in fish, just by coincidence. Now, I'm going to smash the data down so that I spend a lot of time on airplanes making my PowerPoint slides move. Then, because you see the data is still there, but I've changed the y-axis. Because these are data from California now, showing levels of atrazine in field workers, and I'm going to smash that down again, because now these are levels of atrazine in men who apply atrazine. 2,400 parts per billion. These guys have 24,000 times the atrazine in their urine than we know is associated with low sperm count in Shauna Swan's study in Columbia, Missouri. These guys have 24,000 times the atrazine in their urine than we use to chemically castrate and feminize frogs and fish in my laboratory. One of these guys could pee in a bucket. I could dilute the atrazine in their urine 24,000 times and use the atrazine in their urine to chemically castrate and feminize 24,000 tanks of 30 tadpoles each. And of course, most of these men, we know nothing about their reproductive health. They predominantly are Latinx, Mexican-American workers, in some cases who have life expectancies of 40. What's more is if you look at prostate cancer, there's I almost said wonderful study, but it's an awful thing to say about such a thing. There's an 8.4-fold increase in prostate cancer in men who work in their factory bagging atrazine. The company published this, not me. 8.4-fold increase, and they report that the prostate cancer incidence went down when they put in ventilators to remove the atrazine dust in the room. There's at least one study with a p-value of 0.0001 that women whose well water is contaminated with atrazine are more likely to develop breast cancer compared to women who live in the same community but don't use their well water for drinking. And those data have also been supported by laboratory studies by the company. They're peer-reviewed and published, showing that if you give rats atrazine, it increases significantly the incidence of mammary cancer in those rats. Just a coincidence, I guess. What's more is if you look at human cells, and we've published some of this as well, if you take human cancer cells that don't normally express aromatase and make estrogen, you give them atrazine, and they start expressing aromatase and making estrogen, just like we've shown in fish, just like we've shown in amphibians, just like they've shown in reptiles, just like they've shown in birds, just like they've shown in laboratory rodents. These are human cell lines doing the same thing that all vertebrates do when they're exposed to atrazine. What's more is one of my graduate students showed that if you give breast cancer cells atrazine, it induces CYP19, which is the gene for aromatase. Now, that's problematic because, of course, breast cancer depends on estrogen. And in fact, your likelihood of getting breast cancer is mostly predicted by your lifetime exposure to estrogen. But you usually get breast cancer after menopause, when your estrogen levels are lower than they've ever been in your life. That's because this enzyme, aromatase, is expressed in fibroblasts around the developing breast cancers. And so the cancers essentially, the tumors, make their own estrogen that bind to the estrogen receptor and cause those damaged cells to turn into tumors and to spread. In fact, the local expression of aromatase is so important that the number one treatment for breast cancer right now is a chemical called letrozole that blocks aromatase, that decreases estrogen so that your damaged cells don't grow and divide. Imagine the impact then of having the number one contaminant of drinking water, which does exactly the opposite. It turns on aromatase, increases estrogen production, and is associated with breast cancer and promotes breast cancer in rats. You can imagine the trouble that I got into when I pointed out that Novartis Oncology at the time were making both chemicals. I published a paper called The One-Stop Shop, Chemical Causes and Cures for Breast Cancer. Because the same company, yeah, I didn't like that so much either, the same company that was giving us 80 million pounds of atrazine, which turns on aromatase, was selling letrozole to block aromatase in breast cancer. So if you were living in the Midwest, taking letrozole to treat your breast cancer, it was fighting it out with a chemical that was the number one selling product of the same company. So I think that my interest and my love in this aquatic organism has taught me quite a bit about this aquatic organism. Because see, we develop an aquatic environment and we depend on the same hormones as my top model. What we also know about atrazine from other work, not mine, is that it's associated with prostate and mammary cancer in rats. It causes immune failure in rats. It causes retarded neural development and damage in rats when you're exposed in utero. And the next study I'm going to show you impacted me more than any work that I did on my own on atrazine. It's been shown that if you give rats atrazine, they're more likely to have an abortion because of the hormone balance that the atrazine creates. This was published by the EPA. Of those rats that don't abort, the sons are born with prostate disease. The sons, the male pups, are born with the prostate of an old man. Of those rats that don't abort, the daughters are born with impaired mammary development such that when they grow up, their offspring suffer from retarded growth and development because the mothers can't make enough milk. This impacted me because think about this. The rat on the bottom never saw atrazine. The rat on the bottom was affected by atrazine that its grandmother was exposed to. The rat on the bottom never saw atrazine. The rat on the bottom was affected by atrazine that its grandmother was exposed to. And so I'm just a little boy who likes frogs, but when I think about my little girl, when I think about my son, when I think about you, when I think about the fact that your grandchildren, my grandchildren, could be affected by chemicals that we're using today. It's not my work, but it's peer-reviewed and published. A colleague has already shown that birth defects go up if you get pregnant during peak atrazine contamination. It's just a correlation. Some of those effects, and I apologize for the graphic images that I'm going to show, but a picture's worth more than 1,000 words in this case. Some of those birth defects include things like gastroschisis. I didn't know what that was. Now I have a student who's a doctor who sent me a photograph of what this is. It's when the baby's born with the intestines outside of its body. And there's a mechanism associated with estrogen that is associated with this birth defect. Probably more pertinent to my work, another study shown that there's a number of genital malformations in male boys if a pregnant woman is exposed to atrazine when she's carrying those babies. And these birth defects include hypospadias, where the urethra doesn't end all the way through the penis, cryptorchidism, where the testicles don't descend into the scrotum, and microphallus, where the penis doesn't grow. And what's interesting is, all of these effects are known to be associated with either low androgens or exposure to inappropriate estrogen levels, both of which atrazine produces. It's just a correlation. The EPA knows about this. This kind of came up yesterday, so I wanted to show it. The EPA commented on my work and the work of others in an article in the New Yorker magazine. They said, a monetary value is assigned to disease, impairments, and shortened lives and weighed against the benefits of keeping a chemical in use. That's why it's still on the market. So finally, in the last few minutes, I want to talk about our model is a good model for vertebrate animals in general, and maybe even for humans, and predicting effects. But does she really make predictions about other frogs or other amphibians? And so what I'm going to tell you now is while she's great, Xenopus laevis, the African-American clawed frog, while she's great for predicting these effects, maybe not so much for frogs. One is, you see a spectrum of effects. I mean, I showed you some dramatic pictures, but if you treat a tank of tadpoles and grow them up with atrazine, in some cases you see males that are completely unaffected. They have testosterone, they have a cloaca that looks like a male, they have breeding glands, they have a larynx that looks like a male, they have sperm in their testes, and they breed like a male. They're the ones on top. Then you have some animals that grow up, they have low testosterone, they still have a cloaca that looks like a male, but they have low breeding glands, they have a larynx that looks like a female, so they have no sperm in the testes, and they don't breed at all. They're just not interested. They're demasculinized. And then you have some animals that are partially feminized. They actually have low estrogen levels. They have a cloaca, see the back end, that looks like a female's. They have no breeding glands. They have some female parts. So for example, these are oviducts in a male. This is the equivalent of a man with a uterus. And these animals, one of my graduate students just shows, tend to breed like a female. They tend to attract other males and copulate, even though they can't produce eggs. They tend to be involved in these same-sex behaviors. And then you have some females, or some males that are exposed to atrazine in the same tank. They develop cloacal labia, so this is an apparatus for laying eggs that males don't have. I don't know if it's called cloacal labia. That's what I call it, though. I made it up. But it's published now, so everybody has to call it that. And if you look inside, they have a larynx that looks like a female's. They're full of eggs, and they're completely functional as females. So surprise, surprise, not all individuals respond the same. The company likes to talk about things like irreproducibility, but there's variability. And what this shows is that individuals and their individual parts differ in their sensitivity to atrazine and to estrogen, in fact. What's more is even if you look at the same part, here's the gonad of a genetic male that I just showed you. It's a hermaphrodite. That means that some parts of the gonad were more sensitive than others to the estrogen. Some of it's still a testis, some of it's still an ovary. So even within the same organ, there's variability in sensitivity. But what's more is, and I promised somebody, this is my favorite slide, I promised I was gonna show it five times. There's incredible variation between individuals. So what you're looking at is a data set that's in excess of over 10,000 animals produced over 10 years. Students were quitting my lab every time I said, no, we're gonna do it again. Each one of those bars is at least 100 tadpoles from one pair of animals, and the pairs are listed on the bottom. What you're looking at are all genetic males. The ones in blue are the ones that develop testes, the ones in red are the ones that develop ovaries, and the ones in yellow are the hermaphrodites that have both. I can give you any answer you want. I can pick an animal, a pair of animals on the left, and give them estrogen. This is 3 nanograms per mil estrogen, and every one of them will turn into a female. Or I can do an experiment with one of the animals on the far right and give it estrogen, and it looks like estrogen's not estrogenic. What's more is, all the ones on the left that are sensitive are animals that I collected from San Francisco, San Diego, or Africa, and all the ones that are insensitive, all the ones that are insensitive come from these companies where you order your frogs. So imagine that. If I were a company and I wanted to show that my chemical wasn't estrogenic, I'd pick one of these commercially available animals. If I were a company and I wanted to discredit a researcher that said their compound was estrogenic, but certainly the company wouldn't say that. They'd say things like, research that we have funded does not match what Hayes is showing. And certainly, they wouldn't do this on purpose to try to discredit me. In fact, they said, because I've made this claim, they are troubled by a suggestion that we have ever tried to discredit anyone. Our focus has always been on communicating the science and setting the record straight. They are troubled that they have at the notion that they've ever tried to discredit anyone. Turns out some court documents came out, some of their secret studies that were filed under seal and confidential. Where did this idea come from that they were trying to discredit me? Look at their main goal under the science, under strategy. Discredit Hayes. And not only that, they made this whole list of things that they were gonna do to me if I didn't stop doing my research that included investigating my family background, investigating my wife, my favorite, set a trap. Somebody sat in a meeting and wrote, set a trap, and then turned it into a judge and thought that I wasn't gonna get it and clown them on it. But you can easily see how the work is not reproducible. The other reason that this is important, this is time number 4, by the way, that I've shown this slide. The other reason that this is important is because this means that there might be incredible variability out there. And this means also because we can select for resistance or sensitivity in just 2 generations. And that's significant because this is the ranger in San Diego where I collected my frogs 22 years ago. And what he's pointing out, which I didn't know at the time, is that we're collecting from this site. There are also frogs at this site. And you know what all that is in between? A golf course that uses an incredible amount of pesticides. So now we're studying upstream and downstream to try to look at how this population has sustained itself on both sides of all this pesticides. What's more, as I grew up in South Carolina, and an article just came out showing that the only national park in South Carolina is contaminated with atrazine and ethinyl estradiol. And a whole article talks about the people in the canoes and what if they fall in. Nothing about the low-income black communities that live around the swamp in the national park, and nothing about the 19 species of frogs that are exposed in the national park, which was developed to protect the wildlife in the first place. If I can't even take one pair of these frogs and make predictions about the rest of the population, how can I possibly go into an environment and make predictions about 19 other species of frogs? How can I go into a place that's supposed to be pristine and ask questions about using Xenopus as a model, what's happened in the swamp, let alone how can I do that in an area like Salinas that's surrounded by agriculture and surrounded by many more contaminants than I can count. That's it. Thank you again for your time and for the invitation.
Thank you so much, Tyrone. We have time for one, maybe two questions.
Hi, really great talk. I was wondering if there's been anyone that looked at the genetic differences between the commercially bought frogs and the wild frogs to see if it's mutations in genes or if it's like an epigenetic change that might be causing this.
So, yes, my entire lab is focused on this question. In terms of the population, they're all originated from around Cape Town, except for the one population I have from northern South Africa. So they're all the same, quote, population, or same strain, if you will. But we're now looking at which genes might be turned on and off to make them more sensitive or not. We also have a line now that spontaneously produces females from all genetic males. Like 80% of the genetic males spontaneously without estrogen become female. Probably an epigenetic effect after generations of exposure. We're looking at that both in the wild in San Diego as well as in my laboratory.
Hey, Dr. Hayes, I'm just curious. I had read that the EPA last June had put atrazine on a list where it was being looked at very closely, and a lot of environmentalists thought this was the beginning of the possibility that it would be banned. So where is that now?
So atrazine in California under Prop 65 is listed as a reproductive toxin, and that puts it on the list to be reviewed more carefully. The review by the EPA took over 20 years. I initially testified at that review, and a huge document was just released saying that yes, atrazine is a reproductive toxin in across vertebrates, aquatic and non-aquatic. Whether or not anything's going to happen now, that line, for example, that you know a price is put on, that was the Obama's EPA. So, what might happen now is anybody's guess. But yes, that document has come out, and I understand there's another report that looks at human health that's also supposed to come out soon.
Thank you.
Thank you.